right, Exodus chapter 5. Moses has returned to Egypt. Remember, God spoke to Moses in the burning bush, said, go and tell Pharaoh, let my people go. So we've got this narrative assorted. Moses has returned to Egypt. He's talked to the Israelites a little bit already. He spent some time around them. He did miracles for the Israelites. Now, the Egyptians will not accept the miracles that Moses does. The Israelites take these miracles as a sign that this guy is from our God. You remember last chapter, God gave him the name Yahweh. This is my name. Tell them that Yahweh has sent you. All right, so Exodus chapter 5 begins like this. Oh, remember, Aaron is accompanying Moses to help him tell him speak. So they're going to do this together. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. But Pharaoh said, who is the Lord? Okay, so real quick, if you're looking in your Bible, you'll notice that this is the L-O-R-D is in all capitals. This is when the name of God is being used. It's when it's in all capitals in your Bible. So if I were to read this with the original word, it would be, afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, thus says the Yahweh, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. But Pharaoh said, who is this? Who is the Yahweh that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh, and moreover, I will not let Israel go. Then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please go. Please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to Yahweh our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with a sword. But the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens. And Pharaoh said, behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens. The same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, you shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as in the past. Let them go and gather the straw from themselves. But the number of bricks that they made in the past you shall impose on them. They shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it and pay no regard to lying words. All right, so when Moses confronts Pharaoh, Pharaoh refuses. He says, I'm not going to let your people go. He points out that the people, he says, you're making the people idle, that Moses is distracting them from their work. Now, if Pharaoh was being honest, and Moses was distracting them from their work, and all Pharaoh cared about was getting these things built, he wouldn't have taken the straw away. Rather, he intentionally makes it more difficult for the Israelites to do the work. He intentionally reduces productivity. They're supposed to come out with the same number of bricks, but really they're going to be working harder. They're not going to be working as well. So essentially, he's pretty much guaranteeing that there's going to be reduced productivity. He is not acting like a businessman here. He's acting like a tyrant. The whole point of what he's doing is to make the Israelites miserable, not to get them back to work to get his projects done. So there's no sort of way that you can look at this and say, well, you know, the Israelites are just being idle. He's just trying to fix that problem, even though that's what it sounds like he's saying. All right, so Pharaoh is dishonest. Let's establish that right here and now. That's going to be important going forward. All right, verse 10, so the taskmasters and the foremen of the people went out and said to the people, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go and get your straw yourselves, wherever you find it, but your work will not be reduced in the least. So the people were scattered throughout the land of Egypt to gather straw, stubble for straw. The taskmasters were urgent, saying, complete your work, your daily task each day, as when there was straw. The foremen of the people of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not done all of your tasks, making bricks today and yesterday, as in the past? All right, so the foremen, if I understand this correctly, the foremen would be the Israelites. The taskmasters would be the guys with the whips. The foremen would be the Israelites who were directing the other Israelites to make bricks. To make bricks in this way, I mean, this is a pretty traditional way to make bricks. This is not the bricks that the pyramids are made of. The pyramids are made of, I believe, sandstone. They're made of, or limestone. One of those. I think it's limestone. Those are giant stone things that are cut out of a mountain and transported. Whereas these bricks would be, you smush mud and straw together, and it holds together, it binds together that way. And you build sort of mud huts or clay plants.
Like adobe houses.
What was that?
Like adobe houses.
Like adobe houses, exactly. So this is a worldwide thing, is making bricks kind of out of mud, out of clay. We have the red clay bricks that we have. That's just an industrialized version of the kind of bricks that were handmade before. When I lived out in Panama, I remember them making bricks there. I remember specifically, I thought that one of their tools looked like a ladder because it's got these rungs, and they would pack kind of mud. Well, I thought it was mud, it was clay. They would pack clay in between each of the legs of the ladder, and then they would lift the ladder up, and behold, you would have all of these shaped clay things. Now, of course, you'd mix stuff with the clay, like straw in this case, to help it bind together. So this is what they were doing. They were making bricks, and you make all kinds of buildings out of bricks. Again, this is not going to be referring to the Israelites pushing around big blocks for the pyramids. Could that have been part of their job at some point? Maybe, but that's not what's going on here. All right, so the taskmasters are beating up the foreman, and as we say in the military, that kind of thing rolls downhill. If the sergeant is chewed out by the captain, then the sergeant will chew out his people. Those under them will be miserable as well. Yeah, you pass it down, yeah. verse 15, then the foreman of the people of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, "Why do you treat your servants like this? No straw is given to your servants, yet they say to us, 'Make bricks.' And behold, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people." But he said, "You are idle. You are idle. That is why you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice the Lord.' So you are just lazy." It's like, well, you're beating us. You're not helping us do our job. It's just, no, you're lazy. You're lazy, and that's why I'm beating you, because you want to go and sacrifice to God. I'll give you something to do instead. Go now and work. No straw will be given to you, but you must still deliver the same number of bricks. The foreman of the people of Israel saw that they were in trouble, and they said, "You shall by no means reduce the number of bricks, your daily task each day." They met Moses and Aaron, who were waiting for them, as they came out from Pharaoh, and they said to them, "The Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." Then Moses turned to the Lord and said, "O Lord, why have you done evil to the people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak your name, he has done evil to the people, and you have not delivered your people at all." All right, so Moses' job is to deliver God's people, to let God's people go. And this frustration that Moses and these other people are having is, we're doing what God says, but our life isn't better. In fact, our life is markedly worse. It seems like Pharaoh hates these people for being believers. Now he punishes them with the bricks and stuff like that, and with beatings. But as a result of God's word, as a result of being believers, these people are being persecuted. You will see that this is a trend throughout history. You'll see this obviously later on in the New Testament as well, when the Christians are persecuted, and then after the New Testament. To this day, being a believer, speaking God's word, speaking God's uncomfortable truth will get you targeted. It doesn't make your life easier to tell Pharaoh, "Hey, let us go," and, to tell your boss, "Hey, I need to go and go to church on Sunday." Thankfully, we live in a country where this isn't as common, but you can imagine going to your boss in another country, another time, saying, "Hey, I need to worship on Sunday." And he says, "You're just being lazy. You just want a day off. You should be working 7 days a week. There are 7 days in a week. That's how many days you should work." So yeah, in this case, the people are being persecuted for being faithful to God. Moses is frustrated about this. He says, "You said you were going to deliver God, you were going to deliver the people. Instead, the people are more miserable." What Moses is doing now, he might have not had the right attitude, but he's not wrong in what he says. Remember, God did promise to deliver the Israelites. So what he's saying is, "God, you promised this thing. You promised this thing. I want this thing that you promised." It sounds disrespectful, but it's not disrespectful to use God's own words and bring them to him. When God promises something, you say, "God, you promised this. I want this thing that you promised." It's saying, "I trust that you were trustworthy, that you haven't forgotten, that you're going to do what you said. This is what you said you were going to do. I remember it. I know you remember it. Let's get it done." All right. So God has a plan for this. All right. This section is called God's Promise for Deliverance. Chapter 6. Exodus chapter 6. But the Lord said to Moses, "Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will send them out, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land." So Pharaoh won't just let God's people go. Pharaoh will force them out of the country. So this isn't just Pharaoh says, "I guess I'll let go." But this is Pharaoh saying, "Get them out of the country." This is what God's promise is going to be. God spoke to Moses and said to him, "I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty. But my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them." Remember, that was the burning bush when he said that was my name, Yahweh. "I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land which in which they lived as sojourners. Moreover, I heard the groaning of the people of Israel when the Egyptians hold as slaves, and I remembered my covenant. Say, therefore, to the people of Israel, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm, with great acts of judgment. I will take you to be my people. I will be your God, and you shall know that I am Yahweh your God, who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you for a possession. I am Yahweh." Moses spoke thus to the people of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses because of their broken spirit and the harsh slavery. So a couple of things here. This is not a new promise. This is a reiteration of the promise. Yahweh is saying, that thing that I promised, I will deliver it. I promised it before, and I'm still going to deliver it. Pardon? Oh, we're at verse 10. Chapter 6, verse 10 is going to be next. And I really would like to do a study on kind of the different types of body parts described of God, where it says the arm of God, the face of God, the hand of God, things like that. From a cursory look, it looks like whenever it talks about the arm of God or the strong hand of God, so it says a strong hand in verse 1, and in verse 6 it talks about God's outstretched arm. It's often talked about the strong arm of God as either protection or judgment. So he's smashing people with the arm, or he's protecting people with his arm or with his hand. So this seems to be something that comes up a bit. Let's see. It's the same covenant as before. This isn't a new promise. This is the same promise. But the people are not believing because they're miserable. Thankfully, God following his promise does not depend on whether or not the people earn it by being good Israelites. You'll notice consistently in the Old Testament, the Israelites rebel. They're naughty. They don't listen. They don't do what they're told. But God remains faithful even though they are regularly unfaithful. So they do not earn in any way, they do not earn their way out of Egypt. If you want to make a parallel to salvation from the consequences of sin, please do. They are brought out of Egypt, not by their own power. So the Lord said to Moses, verse 10, verse 11, "Go in, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the people of Israel go out of his land." But Moses said to Yahweh, "Behold, the people of Israel have not listened to me. How then shall Pharaoh listen to me? For I am of uncircumcised lips." But the Lord spoke to Moses, and Aaron gave him a charge about the people of Israel and about Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, to bring the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. All right, so then this next section here seems like a little bit of an interruption. But again, you'll see that this is kind of a pattern that did this with Esau's genealogy as well. We have a story picking up steam, and then it'll jump back and say, by the way, this is who these people are, in case you forget. All right, so I'll get through this pretty quick. Verse 14, "These are the heads of the fathers' houses, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. These are the lands of Reuben, the sons of Simeon, Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. These are the clans of Simeon. These are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations. Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. The years of the life of Levi being 137 years. The sons of Gershon, Libni, and Shimei by their clans. The sons of Kohath, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel, the lands of the life, or the years of the life of Kohath being 133 years. The sons of Merari, Mahli, and Mushi. These are the clans of the Levites according to their generations. Amram took his wife Jochebed and his father's sister, and she bore him Aaron and Moses. The years of the life of Amram being 137 years. The sons of Izhar, Korah, Nepheg, and Zichri. The sons of Uziel, Mishael, Elzaphan, and Sithri. Aaron took as his wife Elishaba, the daughter of Aminadab, and the sister of Nashon, and she bore him Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar, the sons of Korah. Keep that in mind, the sons of Korah, they come in later. Asir, Elkanah, and Abiasaph. They were the clans of the Korites. Eleazar, Aaron's son, took as his wife one of the daughters of Putiel, and she bore him Phinehas. These are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites by their clans. These are the Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, "Bring the people of Israel out from the land of Egypt by their hosts." It was by they who spoke to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, about bringing the people of Israel out of Egypt, and Moses to Aaron. On the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, the Lord said to Moses, "I am the Lord. Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you." But Moses said to the Lord, "Behold, I am of uncircumcised lips. How will Pharaoh listen to me?" So this is the narrative. Pause in the narrative. By the way, here's a reminder of who all the people are, in case you forgot. Here's how they're all connected to each other. This is where we are in the narrative. Back to the narrative. So that's what that section was. It's more for reference. There's a couple of names in there that'll come up later. You'll hear about Korah's rebellion a little bit, but they'll come up later. All right. Back to the story. Exodus chapter 7. And the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have made you like a god to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I commanded you, and your brother Aaron shall tell Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go out of the land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I will multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt, and I will bring my hosts, my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out all the people of Israel from among them." Moses and Aaron did so. They did just as the Lord commanded them. Now Moses was 80 years old and Aaron was 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh. I think somebody was asking last week kind of how old they would be. So again, Charlton Heston, white beard, that makes sense. All of this is kind of Old Testament, 80 years old, so he's probably got a little bit more a little bit more energy than people later on would have. All right, so they're speaking to Moses. God says, basically, he says, "I will make you like God to Pharaoh." So he's not saying that he will make him a literal divine being, but this is a major insult, a major slap in the face of Pharaoh, because this is going to come up in just a minute. Because Pharaoh, you've got all the gods of Egypt. Pharaoh considered himself the god of all gods. So you've got the pantheon of gods. Let's say all the Greek gods or whatever you're familiar with, Pharaoh would be Zeus, king over all of the gods. So Pharaoh considered himself and was regarded as the god over all of the gods of Egypt, over Amun-Ra, over Seth, over all of the gods of Egypt. That was Pharaoh. So for Moses, this guy who had run away from Egypt because he was a murderer, to come back in and for God to say, "I will make you as God to Pharaoh," Moses is saying, however much Pharaoh esteems himself, God is going to place Moses over him. He's going to put his words in Moses' mouth. And when Moses speaks, it will be as though God himself is speaking to Pharaoh. So this is a major insult to Pharaoh that he absolutely deserves. He will be dethroned as not the king of Egypt, but as the god over all gods. The real God is sending a prophet, Moses, and saying, "I will speak through Moses." So this is going to come up later. I'm going to explain it in just a minute, the concept of Pharaoh's God.
Question?
Yes, ma'am.
Would that have been all the pharaohs, or just this particular?
Yes, so the role of Pharaoh would be, it would include not just king, but he would be seen as a divine figure. Caesar would do this as well. Caesar, when you burn a pinch of incense to Caesar in the Roman times, you would be regarding him as a god, not as just a king. You're not just giving taxes, but you're literally bowing down and worshiping this god. Although to the pharaohs, plural, this was more of a religious thing. To the Roman Caesars, they more understood their Caesar as less of a divine figure, more of like a king with divine power, I guess. All right, chapter 7, verse 8. Then the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, when Pharaoh says to you, prove yourselves by working a miracle, then you shall say to Aaron, take your staff and cast it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did just as the Lord commanded. Aaron cast down his staff before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Then Pharaoh summoned wise men. So think about magi. That would be the same word, I think. Wise men and sorcerers, and they, the magicians of Egypt, also did the same by their secret arts. For each man cast down his staff, and they became serpents. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staff. Still, Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. All right, so this is one thing to keep in mind, is that these are the demonic forces. These are not believers. These are magicians, sorcerers, people of an entirely different religion, and yet they have the power to perform miracles. The Bible talks about, even in the New Testament, it says that there are many people who will come, many false Christs and false prophets, and they will try to deceive, if possible, even the elect. They will do this by performing great signs and wonders. So it is possible for the demonic to do miraculous signs, but they're nothing compared to what God can do. So in this case, those demonic workers of magic were able to turn staffs into serpents by their secret arts, by their demonic power, their dark arts, etc. And then Moses' staff ate up these other serpents, just to demonstrate how how minuscule they are compared to God's power. But that wasn't enough to convince Pharaoh. This is when you get into one of the favorite sections of a lot of people, I don't want to just say the kids, because it's a great section, the plagues of Egypt. Now, before I get into them, and I will get into them, is I tried to look this up because there's a couple of different variations I found of this information. Now, off the top of your head, without cheating and looking, can you think of some of the plagues of Egypt, any of the plagues? The blood, the locusts, the frogs. The firstborn, the darkness, the hailstorm, things like that. So there's 10 plagues in Egypt. They go like this: the water to blood, the frogs, gnats or lice, flies, sick cattle, plagues and boils, hail, locusts, darkness, and finally the death of the firstborn son. Now, off the top of your head, this is an interesting collection of plagues. Yes, sir.
There's also the firstborn animals, too.
The firstborn animals. I think that's, which one is that under? Is that part of the firstborn one? Okay, well we'll get to that. So when I heard this story about a million times as a kid, I thought, okay, this is just kind of a cool collection of God's doing these random things. A lightning bolt here, a fireball there, that kind of stuff. And God does call down fire on Sodom and Gomorrah, and he calls down fire with Elijah and stuff like that, but there's no fire involved in this one. There's no lightning, there's no storms involved in this one. This is an odd collection of plagues. But what a lot of people assume, and I think it makes sense, although I don't know that we know all the details, is that what God is doing is he's not just doing these random plagues. He's picking out 10 of the Egyptians' favorite gods and insulting them. Each of these plagues corresponds to a different god or multiple gods that the Egyptians worship. They worship a lot of gods. So I've got a collection of these things. So when God turned the water to blood, so this isn't just water, this is the Nile River, this is the lifeblood, if you will. This is how Egypt is alive in the desert, is because of the Nile. Because the Nile was the source of so much life, naturally they turned to worshiping the Nile and considering it almost a god in and of itself. So there's actually three gods that I have on this list. There's Khnum, the guardian of the river. There's Hapi, the spirit of the Nile. This is probably the one that I think it's related to. The Nile is embodied as its own spirit. And there's Osiris. The Nile was his bloodstream. So if I'm just going to focus on Hapi, so this was the source of Israel, of Egypt's power. This was the source of Egypt's ability to stay alive, this water. So for God to specifically target this and say, hey, you know that God that keeps you alive, that river that you worship? It's dead now. Because turning water to blood doesn't just, it's not just, oh cool, it's red. It's, I can't drink that, I can't bathe in that, I can't cook that. That now makes everything stink. Lots of blood makes everything stink, smells like pennies. It is completely, so the source of life for them that they were worshiping, the water, becomes a source of death. If they were drinking it, they would die. They would not survive if they lived off the water. So God is slapping the first god of the Egyptians in the face by turning their sacred Nile, their sacred river, into a source of death instead of a source of life, instead of a source of wealth and power. The second plague, frogs, this was, some people connected this to Hekt or Hapi. They are related to fertility. You'll notice that it wasn't just one or two frogs. It was frogs everywhere. So again, this is an insult to fertility. Their goddess of fertility. It says, oh, you want to worship, or I think it's a goddess. Yeah, I don't remember. You want to worship fertility, right? Okay, have some fertility. Have some fertility with the face of your god. Because this was, remember the Egyptians had these animal-faced gods. This was one that was represented by a frog a lot of times. Oh, you like frogs and fertility? Okay, have as many frogs as you'd like. Frogs everywhere, frogs in your sandwiches, frogs in your bed, frogs in your sandals, frogs everywhere. So again, it turns this god that these Egyptians worshipped into an insult. Next, you've got the plague of gnats or lice. There's a couple that I saw connected, a couple gods connected to this. One of them is Seb, the god, the earth god. Let me see what this one says. Yeah, so it's called, he's kind of the god of dust. So if you're living in Egypt, there's sand everywhere. So again, because it's everywhere, you turn it into a god. They're like, okay, well, you know, oh, holy sand god, please stay out of my, you know, please stay out of my sandals or something like that. So again, he's saying, okay, well, what if you have this sand and it's alive and it bites you? So as numerous as the sand, that's as much as sand gets everywhere, guess what? Your bug-faced god is now going to be mocked by putting lice everywhere. You want sand? You got sand. You got living sand that now bites you and makes you itch everywhere. And by the way, I'm using the face of your god to do it. He's not done. The fourth plague is flies. Now, one of the lists that I have, it connects it to Khepri. This is the beetle god who moves the sun around like a dung beetle moves around a ball of dung. But I don't like that as much. Uatchit is another fly god. So again, God insults them by using their own god and saying, okay, you like flies so much? Guess what? Have as many flies as you want. And then at this point, he starts separating the plagues that are befalling the Egyptians. So before this, there's frogs everywhere. At this point, he starts specifically targeting the Egyptians. He says, okay, now that I've got your attention, that I'm making fun of all of your gods one at a time, now I'm going to distinguish my people from your people, the people who worship these things from the people who worship me. My people are not going to be affected by these plagues going forward. All right, so at this point, you've got the fifth plague is the sick cattle. Let me see which one this one says. So there's a lot of cow gods. Hathor is probably the one that I'm thinking of. So there are Egyptian gods associated with bulls and cows. Okay, you've got the bull would be strength, and whereas the cow would be kind of milking the cow, that would be kind of sustenance. I forget which goddess it was, but she's often depicted with a crown that's got like cow horns on it. I've got paintings. I think I got a painting of it in my office somewhere on a papyrus. But okay, you look to these cow gods as for strength. You look to these cow gods for giving you life-giving food. Well, guess what? Now your cow god is weak. It's dying of a disease. Now your cow god is so sick that if you try to drink the milk of this cow god, you won't get better. You'll get sick yourself. Again, it's a direct insult to one of their gods. And God continues to go and insult their gods. Next up is the boils. All right. The one that you may have heard of is Sekhmet. This would be the Egyptian goddess of epidemics. So you seem like, not Hermes. Hermes has the staff with the two snakes, but there's a staff with one snake, and that's supposed to represent, I forget what the Greek god's name is, but it's basically, you see it, it's connected to pharmaceuticals or whatever. What was that? That might have been it. I don't remember specifically. But yeah, so you know the symbol, and it's often used to depict, okay, this is related to medicine somehow. Well, this in different cultures, you would often have the god or goddess of healing, of epidemics, of sickness, of pharmaceuticals, of medicine, that sort of thing. So again, all right, you've got a god you specifically picked out to heal your illnesses. Here's one, boils. Go ahead, call to your goddess. See if she helps you. I notice that she's pretty quiet right now. Keeps going on. The next plague is hail. Nut, this is the Egyptian sky goddess. So at this point, you're getting to the higher level of, up until this point, you've kind of gotten mid-level gods that are being insulted. You know, how dare you insult our cow god? How dare you insult our, you know, our river god or whatever? River god, the Nile god would be pretty significant. But at this point, if you're picking things to be gods, they pick the sky to be the god. So Nut is the god, the goddess of the sky. You would also have Isis, you've maybe heard of this, and Set. These are agricultural deities. I think it's either Set or Sekhmet. Well, I forget how to pronounce it, the alligator one. And then you've got Imhotep. You've probably heard of, or not Imhotep. Imhotep would be god of healing. Shu, so the Egyptian god of the atmosphere. So Nut, Isis and Seth, and Shu. So if you're worshiping things around you, if you're an animus and you say, well, this tree is a god, when you start getting bigger and bigger, probably the thing that you worship is the sky, and then over above the sky you worship the sun and the moon. So we're going up here in ranks of how important these things, these gods are that are being insulted here. So if you're worshiping the sky, if you've got a sky god, how come your sky god is throwing down hailstones and destroying everything, huh? Huh, Egyptians? Where is your sky god now, huh? I notice your sky god is destroying all of your land. Your sky god must really hate you. You should probably get rid of these Israelites. That's not enough. Next one is the locusts. Serapia. Serapia is an Egyptian goddess of or deity protector from locusts. This one also has this one also lists Napier and Nepri, were the god and goddesses of grain. All right. So if you're an Egyptian, you have to stay alive by all this grain. You remember, grain was kind of an important thing in Egypt. Joseph really helped with the stocking up of grain for the famine. Now, if the Nile is the lifeblood of Egypt in terms of drinking water, grain is how you survive in Egypt by staying alive. Now your source of food is being destroyed by locusts. How come your god isn't defending you against these locust Egyptians? Is your god impotent? Where is your god? Yes, ma'am.
Do we still have the 7-year locusts?
I'm not sure about that. I know that locusts, they've got patterns and migrations and stuff like that, but I don't know the details. All right, plague number 9. Okay, this is when it gets serious. This is, if you're worshiping the sky before and the sun before, this is light itself. This is light itself being worshipped. You may have heard of this Egyptian god. This is how you know it's an important one. Ra. You've probably heard of the Egyptian god Ra. You may have heard of Amun-Ra, Aten, Atum, or Horus. Horus would be the owl, Thoth or Thoth. So these are the gods of either the sun or light or the moon. So it's okay. You want to be able to see 5 feet in front of your face? You're in Egypt. It's hot. It's like Arizona, but hotter. The sun is everywhere. Where is your sun now? Now, before you can make excuses of, oh, it's just this river is poisoned with blood. Oh, it's just locusts or whatever. It's a migratory thing. Where is the sun? Egypt is kind of defined as being a very hot, sunny place. Imagine you're in Arizona, and then all of a sudden God says, okay, no more sun for you. And Arizona is just cold, and there's no sun. That would be significant if Arizona lost its sunlight. Yes, ma'am?
I don't remember
did these last for periods of time, or did they all end up converging and being happening at the same time?
There were periods of time, so they would go back and forth. Moses would say, here's a plague. Pharaoh would say, I'll let your people go. Pharaoh would say, I changed my mind, I'm not going to let your people go. So that's why we know it wasn't all at the same time.
So
yeah.
It was just based on his response.
Yeah, so it would say, so Moses would say, if you take away this, you know, these locusts or whatever, then I'll let your people go. So God took away the locusts. And then Moses changed, or then Pharaoh changed his mind. So it was sequential, not all at the same time. Yeah.
And I have another question.
Yes, please.
So were the magicians also insulting their own gods?
No, they were not insulting their own gods by creating, when they did
the
miracles
that Moses was doing?
No, they weren't insulting their own gods. They were trying to say, look, we can do these things. Our gods have given us the power to make snakes
or
something like this.
In
except Moses overwhelmed them. They overwhelmed them with the magicians would turn water into blood in a small portion. Moses would remove the entire water source. They could say, look, we have power over the water. We can turn some water into blood. And Moses is, that's a parlor trick. Moses is saying, this is a death sentence. You guys can't drink anymore. The God who's supposed to protect you by giving you water is no longer protecting you. So that would be the difference. But yeah.
So they didn't proceed to mimic everything they did?
No. They were only able to mimic, they were only able to mimic the water turned to blood, the snake, staff, and the frogs. At that point, they aren't able to duplicate any of the other ones. All right, so you have Ra, you have Amun-Ra, you have the god of the sun, you have Egypt is known for its sunny sun. It's gone. Where is your sun now, Egypt? Finally, this is why I brought up the Pharaoh as God thing. Finally, you have the biggest insult to the most important Egyptian god of all, bigger than the sun god, bigger than Ra, bigger than Amun-Ra, bigger than Thoth, bigger than Horus, bigger than all the most important Egyptian gods, is Pharaoh himself, the god of all gods. Pharaoh, the most important thing in your life is your lineage, your firstborn son who will take on your name and take on your throne and take on your deity after you die. Guess what? He's gone. Your firstborn son is now taken away from you. Now this plague judged all of Egypt's god, including Pharaoh itself. Remember, Pharaoh had killed the firstborn sons, or tried to kill the firstborn sons of the Israelites. So this is, let's say poetic. This is just, oh, Pharaoh, you think that you're God over all gods and that you can kill the firstborn sons of all others? How's your firstborn son doing? It is brutal. It is an insult beyond insults. This man who made himself to be not just a god, but the god over all gods, has been humbled so heavily, taken away the most important thing in his life, and insulted. Every single one of his gods that was supposed to protect him has been insulted and turned into a joke. And he himself, God over all gods, has been made the biggest joke of them all. So with this, these are not just 10 random plagues. This is increasing not just in severity, but increasing in the level of insult, in the level of in your face, your God is not real and I'm going to prove it. And by the way, while I'm proving it, I'm going to mock your God by using the face of your God in these plagues as well. So we weren't able to get into the plagues yet, but that's the precursor to the plague. So we'll start next time with verse 14. This is the first plague. So keep all of that in mind when we begin next time with Exodus chapter 7, verse 14. All right, let's close with the doxology.